is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle stations.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. This is the aforementioned Sal. We really appreciate you coming on board to join us today for another edition of Midrats. And if you're with that esteemed cohort that's joining us live, if you scroll down to the bottom of the show page, that's where you'll find the chat room. That's a great place to share your observations during the course of the show with the usual suspects and ourselves. And also it's a place that we'll be looking out for if there is a question that you would like for us to address to our guest over the next hour. Please put it in the chat room, and we'll be happy to monitor there and roll it back in as best as we can. And if you got to leave and take care of some business and you want to check up on what you missed for this show or some previous shows that you may not have had a chance to listen to, remember you can get the full archive over at Blog Talk Radio or just take the shortcut and subscribe to the free podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or any of the other aggregators out there. And diving into today's show, obviously for those that keep a weather eye on the national security related incidents out there, whether it's in the maritime arena or Russia, the Kerch Strait again has brought the Russia-Ukraine interface, for lack of a better phrase, above the background noise and into conversation. And in a larger respect, this slow-rolling conflict that's been going on for years has taken a variety of different paths to get to where we are today. And not only is impacting the internal stability of Russia, Ukraine, but outside of those areas, the EU, NATO, and even up here in North America. We want to today to catch up on the latest state of play, not just on that specific incident, but involving Russia and the near abroad and those that are impacted by here. And today we have a great guest that's going to cover that very broad field with us, and she is Emma Ashford. Emma is a research fellow in defense and foreign policy over at the Cato Institute. She's currently writing a book on the links between oil, foreign policy, and war, focusing on the particular politics of petrostates from Russia to Saudi Arabia, Iran, and Venezuela. She holds a PhD from the University of Virginia, and she's with us for the full hour today. Emma, welcome to Midrats.
Great to be here.
Well, again, thank you very much. We've really been looking forward to have this conversation with you. We've talked about Russia during the course of the years on the show, and everybody kind of gets it from a slightly different angle. And I don't know if anybody really sees Russia as clear as we wish them to, but I think if you get enough smart people together, you can at least get a little more of an informed conversation on that. And that kind of is the leading question I wanted to roll your way, Emma, is that it seems that the usual established stable of phrases and descriptions that we use, whether it's in the diplomatic arena or national security arena, to try to describe what Russia has been doing the last year in her near abroad and with Ukraine, whether they're talking in the context of frozen conflicts, post-Soviet interaction with her near abroad, gray zone, little green men, all these phrases out there trying to help educate or at least bring into the conversation what Russia is doing as she reestablishes her place in the world. And what do you think is a useful term or concept or two that might help the listener to better get a visual on what is driving Russia and the actions she's taking?
You know, I think you forgot one of the terms that actually comes up most often, which is hybrid war. But like all of the terms that you named, hybrid war is another one, they're all new terms for things that aren't actually new. We're basically trying to reinvent the wheel here. The things that Russia does in Ukraine, the things that it's done in other countries near abroad, whether it's Belarus, whether it's Kazakhstan, whether it's a bunch of the other Central Asian states, these are all things that states have done for generations, right? Manipulating the elections or the governance of states nearby because you're worried that they might become unfriendly to you. Arming or funding proxies in places where you don't want to actually commit your own troops. States have been doing these things for centuries. It's just that we seem to be trying to come up with an overall term to describe this phenomenon when it comes to Russia, and I'm not sure anybody's been really successful. So the reason that I mentioned hybrid war is because I think that's probably about the most useful term that we've come up with, because it captures the idea that Russia is using a bunch of different tools of statecraft to try and sort of meddle in the countries near its borders. But I'm still not convinced that even that's a particularly great term for this, because what we see in different states is very different. So in Ukraine, it is absolutely Russia engaging in military means, economic means, to try and manipulate politics and even the stability of Ukraine. But in a lot of other countries, it's purely political. So I really just don't think we have a good term that encompasses the range of everything Russia's doing across what it calls its near abroad.
Yeah, I think it's, as I started reading about this stuff, I looked at it and I said, you know what, they're doing is nibbling us to death like ducks. You know, that small slices, salami slices, whatever you want to call it, keeping things below a threshold that, requires action by anybody other than expressing alarm. And I think a lot of people have been writing about that. But how much of this is related to their perceived need, at least on my part, to become, to claim the great power status that they once clearly had?
You know, you can look at this from sort of two different points of view. One is that Russia has genuine security concerns, and the other is this sort of normative idea of great power status or respect. So start with the security concerns. A lot of Russia's fears about the countries in the near abroad, basically the bordering countries that used to be part of the Soviet Union and aren't part of Russia anymore, a lot of their fears about those countries joining the West can be seen to be driven by genuine security concerns, right? So the Russians have a long history of being invaded, of having their borders violated. And there is sort of a strategic mindset, basically among a lot of Russian military planners, that says we need to keep these countries as borderlands that we can use as extra protection and padding against other countries. You know, Ukraine actually means borderlands. So for Russians, this is not just a sort of an empty phrase. But the security concerns are real. And Russia is using sort of the means available to it to try and achieve them, to try and prevent Georgia or Ukraine, for example, from joining Western institutions. The second point, though, this idea of Russia wants to be a great power again, I think that's a lot trickier to get at. Definitely an element of truth to it, particularly if you look at the way that Vladimir Putin has, over his sort of, call it 3 to 4 terms in office, however you want to define the Medvedev period, how his government has structured the domestic narrative about Russian foreign policy. A lot of the time it's about emphasizing the fact that Russia has returned to greatness, or Russia is as respected by world powers as it was during the Soviet period. And this plays on those domestic feelings that a lot of Russians have very justifiably about the idea that in the 1990s, Russia basically went from being a world superpower to being nothing, to being poor, to having economic crises, to having everybody in the world give them charity. And so Putin has domestically at least built this narrative of we are a great power once again. It's not reality, however, right? Putin can talk about it all he wants in state media, but the fact is that Russia is I would no longer say it's a great power. It is certainly a major regional power. But Russia, if you look at the strength of the military, if you look at what they're actually capable of achieving in a conflict situation, they are no longer comparable to the Soviet Union. They're no longer a great power. So this is, you know, this is a narrative. It's not actually reality when they talk about the great power thing.
That's a perfect lead-in to the question I want to ask you. And let's keep pulling the thread on that, because when you look at Russia, you know, just take the name of the country away and look at traditional and established definitions of national power. When you look at population, economics, demographics, obviously she has a huge geographic area, but then again, so does Greenland. Not much of it is of practical use. But she really is on the stage outperforming what she should. Yes, she has a large military, but a lot of that is, I guess in many ways, also what she's using, which is accumulated historical capital she inherited from the Soviet Union, along with some legacy military ability from the Soviet Union and this big inventory of nuclear weapons. But how much longer can they, I don't want to say coast, but they have a large a historical inertia with that to be able to play the game that they're playing on the international scene, where when you look at objective criteria, you've got to scratch your head and wonder if they just are accomplishing so much just by attitude, will, and historical inertia.
Some of it is definitely that the Russians are just willing to put themselves out there in a way that, say, other countries wouldn't be. They just seem to have this willingness to do things like engage in the election meddling earlier this year. I think a lot of countries just wouldn't take that step. Of the military, however, Russia's not so much coasting from the Soviet period as it's actually recovering from the post-Soviet period. So we've actually seen a very effective program of military modernization over the last 15 years inside Russia that has seen major procurement programs to replace a lot of that old Soviet equipment. It's seen a shift from a system that was entirely conscription-based over to a system that they had hoped to make it an entirely professional military. They were not able to do that, so now it's a mixed conscription professional military system. And the Russians have also invested a lot of money and effort in training programs, and particularly in the last 5 years have actually used Ukraine and to a much greater extent Syria as places where they're actually sort of almost engaging in like live fire training. Basically, the troops, the Russian troops that are getting rotated through these places are getting combat experience, and it's actually improving their military. So I would sort of quibble a little with your characterization of the Russian military as coasting from the Soviet period. That said, the military does still face a lot of problems in Russia. The demographic factors that you point to, there just aren't that many young people suited for military service. This is a problem. Even with the higher wages that they're now offering, they have not been able to recruit enough people to make the military all professional. And they have a tendency to lose officers if they can't pay them enough. And declining budgets ever since oil prices started falling a couple of years ago have meant that all that military modernization stuff had to get slashed. So while I dispute your characterization that the Russian military is sort of coasting from the Soviet period, I would say they do also still have major problems. And that's part of why they tend to use these unconventional means in a lot of theaters.
Yeah, there's an article in American Interest by Peter Duran and Donald Jensen where they talk about Putin's strategy of chaos. And I think, you know, that there's another piece in War on the Rocks, and the author of that one describes what Russia is doing as raiding in the classic sense, you know, a series of operations or campaigns that integrate indirect and direct approaches, the idea of creating this constant disruption in the international system, or in the case, say, of our domestic politics, it's kind of like the Navy says about how many mines does it take to make a minefield. Well, it doesn't take any. You just have to say you put a mine in the water, you know, to create a chaotic atmosphere. Is there a strategy of chaos that you see that the Russians are putting forward as a strategic goal of that's the question. And what is their strategic goal if they're doing that?
Oh, absolutely. The article in War on the Rocks that you cited, I think it was Michael Kaufman. I love that article because I really think he does get at this idea of what Russia's strategic goals are. So everybody sort of assumes that Russia is trying to conquer territory or collapse NATO or make themselves into a great power again. I don't really think Russia is trying to do any of those things. And what this article basically argues is that Russia is engaged in the strategy of sort of raiding, of just trying to destabilize other actors in the international system. And I think if you look at what Russia's doing near abroad, that is absolutely what it's doing. In Ukraine, in Georgia, Russia's goal has never been to seize large chunks of territory to control Ukraine, to conquer Ukraine. Russia's goal has been to keep Ukraine and indeed Georgia divided, weak, make sure that they have territorial disputes on their territory that mean that they cannot join Western alliances, that they can't move towards the West easily, and make it so that the politics of those countries remain so unstable that Russia can capitalize on it. The same thing applies for the Russian meddling in U.S. elections, perhaps in the Brexit vote. They are simply trying to create enough dissent, enough paranoia, enough worry that they're undermining our system, that they make us focus at home rather than focusing on Russia. And this is a really successful strategy. It's basically an incredibly asymmetric strategy where Russia benefits if it makes us worry or feel less stable. It doesn't even have to achieve any concrete objective in order to feel that this is making it more secure. So I think that article, I would really encourage people to read it, really gets at the heart of what Putin's trying to achieve here.
I think Russia has really gotten some great bang for their buck, whoever is running their PSYOPs and InfoOps program. They should definitely get an extra pat on the back for some of the work they've done. And it's kind of played into something we've seen domestically, and I really liked, and I recommend to our listeners to look up at an article that our guest Emma Ashford wrote over at Foreign Affairs back in April of this year, where you talk about the confrontational status quo. And I had to think back to, you know, the 2012 election. We've come pretty far from dismissive of the 1980s called and would like their foreign policy back, to the point that we can't seem to get the Russian boogeyman from the above-the-fold national security discussions of the day. Talk for a little bit about that default confrontational status quo and how, in the American national interest, it might actually be counterproductive.
So one of the big problems with U.S.-Russian relations in recent years is that we have policymakers have almost never actually considered what American interests are versus what, say, the interests of NATO member states are versus, say, what the interests of Ukraine are. And so what we end up doing is we see a lot of statements from policymakers, presidents, White House, you know, Congress, where we condemn Russian activities in places like Ukraine. We offer them aid. We say this is unacceptable. This breaks all the rules. Then we conflate the idea of an invasion of Ukraine with the idea of an invasion of the Baltic states, which are NATO members. We conflate all of that with election meddling inside Russia. We conflate it with Russia sending agents into the United Kingdom, you know, a U.S. treaty ally, to use chemical weapons on a defector. All of these things sort of get melded together into this sort of general Russia is bad outlook. And Russia is bad, right? Russia is doing terrible things around the world. But not all of those things impact the U.S. the same. In some cases, we have treaty obligations. In some cases, things like our electoral system that fundamentally are very important to the U.S. political system, to life in America, to our safety and security. And in some cases, like the fact that Russia is running an insurgency in eastern Ukraine, those aren't necessarily core interests for the U.S. And so until policymakers sort of learn to stop treating all those things as if they're the same and reacting as if they're all the same and, quite frankly, using the same tools to treat them all as if they're the same, so in every case we sanction Russia and that's the only thing we do, it's going to be very, very difficult to try and actually deter Russia from stopping doing the things we really don't want them to do. So we're not going to be able to deter them from election meddling as long as we let them believe that we think that's exactly the same as their meddling in eastern Ukraine. So I think this, frankly, is the biggest problem in our approach to Russia today. It's one that the Trump administration hasn't wrestled with at all, quite frankly, and we can talk about this a little more. The Trump administration has at least two policies towards Russia, maybe more than that. But it's one that the Obama administration didn't really wrestle with either. So perhaps some future administration will get us there. I hope so.
Well, while we're still focusing kind of on the larger issues, let's talk a little bit about Russia as a petro power. And since you're working on a book along those lines, it might be a good place to stick that in. Is this their major source of income, and how is important to them is the threat they face from the U.S. being able to take over some of the gas exports to Europe and stuff like that? Is this a major problem for them, you think?
Yeah, let me start with that just because I think that's pretty easy to put aside. So there is really no competition on a market level. It's always going to be cheaper to send Russian gas through a pipeline into Europe than it's going to be to ship LNG, liquefied natural gas, from America over to Europe. So the only situation in which the Russians really would have to worry about that is if a bunch of countries for security reasons decided to switch supplies. Thus far, I think only one country, I think it's Lithuania, has committed to doing that for some of their supply. So this just really isn't something that the Russians actually have to worry about. In terms of how dependent they are on energy, though, they are almost entirely dependent on energy. So since 2000, the Russian economy has largely recovered, grown, back from where it was after the Soviet collapse. Russia is now at least moderately prosperous. It would be one of the G8 if we hadn't thrown them out of the G8. Almost all of that comes from resource exporting. The Russian economy is now just incredibly dominated by resource exporting, natural gas and oil, and then some other metals and precious minerals and stuff like that. But it's mostly oil and gas. The Russians export a lot of that to Europe, export some of it to Asia. They've been actually working with the Chinese, the Japanese, the South Koreans, talking about pipelines that would go towards Asia instead. And they are really, really dependent on the price of oil. So a really interesting geopolitical phenomenon that we've seen over the last few years is the Russians and the Saudis are now in close cooperation. Basically, Russia and OPEC are working together to keep the price of oil higher than it would be otherwise through a production agreement. That's something we've never seen before. So Russia is not just sort of dependent on oil and gas. It's not just a major player in that market. It's increasingly a partner of OPEC in actually keeping world oil prices high.
Let's talk a little bit about, you know, her interest, because I've only spent a few days in Russia, and I actually had an interesting conversation with a Russian lady who's just a couple years older than I am, and she really lamented about that fact that, you know, she waved her hand over at a wharf that was just covered with ignits of, I believe it was aluminum. We just export everything, we just sell everything, we don't make anything here anymore, and they do have a lot of strength, also vulnerability there, and I wonder, you know, what is the driving force, do you think, behind Russia's machinations against Ukraine from a strictly military standpoint, and maybe a little bit historical from when they took it from the Ottomans? You know, I could see why they would want
to secure their bases in Crimea. But what is really driving the Russian interest in Ukraine?
So there's a lot of things, right? So start with the cultural factors, right? A lot of Russians have never accepted that Ukraine is a separate country. Ukraine was part of the Russian Empire prior to being part of the Soviet Union. Russia, as we know it today, actually started out with its capital in Kiev, not in Moscow. And then the capital shifted in later centuries. So a lot of Russians simply see Ukraine as, well, we're one country separated by a border. That's not to say that they're right, because most Ukrainians don't necessarily believe that. But Russians start from that point of view, and that's really problematic. And there's the security concerns. So I mentioned this a little earlier about how the Russians like to keep a border against Western Europe. There's a lot of concern among Russian policymakers, defense planners, that Ukraine could eventually shift towards the West and join the European Union and join NATO. So during the George W. Bush era, there was a lot of talk about offering membership action plans for NATO to Ukraine and Georgia. And that prompted, I think, the 2008 war in Georgia for sure, and to a large extent, this intervention that we've seen in Ukraine since 2014. Another security issue that you alluded to as well is the seizure of Crimea. So it's not just about Ukraine as a sort of buffer zone for security. The Russian Black Sea Fleet is actually based at Sevastopol on Crimea. And even after the collapse of the Soviet Union, the Russians had a basing agreement with Ukraine to keep that base there, keep tens of thousands of troops there in Crimea. But during the Orange Revolution in 2004, during the Maidan Revolution, basically every time the Ukrainian government swung towards a more pro-Western stance, the government in Ukraine would make noises about maybe we'll take away that lease from the Russians. And if the Russians were to lose Sevastopol, that's basically their best port, their best warm water port, certainly. All of the other options for them to have ports down on their southern coast are much, much worse, much more restrictive. So Sevastopol is really important to the Russians. So the seizure of Crimea has that security implication as well. And then finally, I think there's just a political motivation. So the Putin regime fears the color revolutions. That's the revolutions that happened throughout the post-Soviet space in the mid-2000s. In a lot of countries, we saw sort of mass protests, governments over, and the governments that came in were almost uniformly pro-Western, pro-democratic, and wanted to have better relations with the West. And Putin, from everything we understand, not only fears that those countries will shift away from him, he also fears that we in the West, that the US, that NATO is actively fomenting those revolutions, and that we're trying to do the same in Moscow, and we're trying to get rid of his regime. And so there is some political fear here, too. And so Russia's meddling inside Ukraine with trying to keep that government weak is also, to some extent, sending a signal saying, well, you're not going to succeed here. We are going to keep Ukraine in our orbit. We're going to keep it politically weak. And you're not going to succeed with your color revolutions here or indeed in Moscow. So when you put all of those things together, Ukraine is probably the place that Russia has the most interest in of basically any country in the near abroad. It's not surprising that it has become this major battleground for them.
I've heard it floated that if the world would accede to Russian control of Crimea completely, that other matters in Ukraine might be more capable of being resolved. Is that optimistic thinking in your view?
You know, I think there's political space for some kind of deal there. I'm not sure Crimea would be sufficient. I think, Sam Sharap, who's over at RAND, wrote a really interesting book with Tim Colton a couple of years back. And it's called Everybody Loses, and it's about the history of Ukraine and how it's been pooled between Russia and the West, and basically treated just as a chess piece. And the people of Ukraine never get to decide what they want, and they end up suffering as a result. And his argument in the book is not just that sort of Russia probably will already has Crimea, will probably have to keep it, but also that there probably has to be some kind of deal that sees Ukraine remain neutral, Finlandized, in the sort of the jargon of the Cold War, that Ukraine would basically agree that it's not going to join NATO or the European Union, that it's not going to unite with Russia in some way, that it's going to remain this kind of middle state that neither side has a monopoly over. And so his argument basically is that until that happens, Russia's always going to have an interest in keeping Ukraine unstable. And so as politically and frankly ethically unpalatable as that deal is, it might be the only way to actually ensure that Ukraine can be peaceful and learn to prosper that way.
Well, I've heard the old the Finlandization concept before, and when I hear that, I think more that Moscow may not want the old Finland model from the Cold War, but more like the relationship they have with Belarus, which is almost, and please tell me this exaggeration, it's almost a commonwealth to a crucial state in the old world. Do you think that is something that ultimately Russia would like to see, that they politically could get the right people in place, that they have the sway over Ukraine that they now enjoy with their neighbor, Ukraine's neighbor to the north, Belarus?
I'm sure the Russians would love to have, a state that is as closely tied to them as Belarus is. Belarus has a common currency, there's a customs union, Russia has a lot of influence there, though I would say that even there, Belarus is not just entirely a vassal state to Russia. The Russians have actually cut off energy supplies to Belarus a couple of times in the last decade because the government there was doing some things they didn't like. So no matter how close Lukashenko in Belarus is to Russia, there are policy differences there. And I think Russia probably would love to have that with Ukraine. They would love to have it with Georgia. They would love to have it with Kazakhstan. If you look at the history of Russia's relations with neighboring states in the post-Soviet period, it's been a project of trying to draw them back into something like a Soviet-style system where obviously Russia is the central power and those states are independent but are to some extent subordinate to it. That said, that's not realistic. There is just no way that Russia is ever going to be able to achieve that with Ukraine, not 10 years ago, and certainly not now after there has been, this war, after they seized Crimea. Public opinion in Ukraine, even among those who are Russian-speaking, who are more inclined towards Russia, is very negative towards Russian conduct during this conflict. There is no prospect of a government in Kiev that would be willing to be so subordinate to Russia. So I really do think that the best the Russians can hope for, and perhaps the best we can hope for too, is this sort of Finland model where the government is relatively neutral towards both sides, but has, say, trade ties with both sides.
Yeah, I somewhere back in my mind, back during the Kosovo War, Russia was vaguely, I think, as my recollection is, that somebody was proposing that Russia might be willing to join NATO, and certainly they had some cooperation at that time. Is that kind of thinking completely out the window now with the current Russian government?
Oh, I think that went away 15, even 20 years ago at this point.
I'm sure it did.
But it wasn't a crazy idea at the time. Genuinely, in the immediate aftermath of the Cold War, the George H.W. Bush administration and then the Clinton administration, they both suggested to Russia that eventually perhaps it could join NATO, or at the very least that we would build some kind of larger security architecture that would include the Russians. That's what the Partnership for Peace was. that was formed in the 1990s, then Russia, then NATO, sort of working together in this broader framework. The thing that happened to that process was that over the course of the 1990s into the 2000s, it basically became clear to Moscow that that was never going to happen, and that the plans of particularly U.S. policymakers were to keep expanding NATO instead, basically gobbling up all the states that had formerly been members of the Warsaw Pact. So at a certain point, sometime after Putin comes to power, we see Russian policymakers and defense planners start to react against this. Instead of saying, oh, we should be cooperating with the West, we will be eventually building something bigger with them, we're partners in security. Instead, you see this hostility, this idea that they start to see NATO coming towards them, encircling them, encroaching on their territory as they see it, even if it's not actually their territory. And the prospects for cooperation get worse. They get a lot worse in Putin's sort of second term in office. They get a little better under Medvedev, but as Putin comes back into power, they get much, much worse. And so the whole of the post-Cold War period has with Russia basically been the story of just declining relations, getting worse and worse and worse as the West sort of takes more and more and fails to include Russia in any security architecture. And I do want to sort of just mention, you mentioned the Kosovo intervention in passing. That is actually a major turning point in how a lot of Russian policymakers think about NATO, think about the West. Because for them, the Kosovo intervention wasn't an anti-genocide intervention. It was NATO intervening, violating the sovereignty of a state, Serbia, that Russia had strong historic ties with, strong cultural ties with. And actually, during that intervention, the Russians actually staged their own intervention. They sent a bunch of paratroopers in to try and capture the Pristina airport before NATO troops could do it. And they failed to get there in time. But there was actually a situation on the ground where NATO and Russian troops came very close to firing on one another. The orders were actually to fire on one another, and the generals in the field, the colonels in the field, actually disobeyed those orders. So Kosovo really is the turning point where we start to see Russians realize, basically, that the future is not going to be NATO membership. The future is not going to be partnership with NATO. It's going to be something else.
Yeah, that was somebody who was actually offshore when all that was going on. It was a humiliating moment in a lot of ways for Russia, and even inside NATO, there was a lot of discussions about, do we really know what we're doing here in the long term? And that does stick around with a lot of people. And it on the flip side of that is, you've got to give kind of a little golf clap to the Russians, because it's been interesting to watch the arc of their return to the Middle East from their initial tentative steps in Syria to when they realized what was available there, to really becoming a significant player and turning things around for Assad. And that arc, I guess you could say the latest data point was that bizarre bro shake between Putin and the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Sultan, in Argentina at the G20. Emma, where do you see, as Russia returns back to being a player of no small amount in the Mideast, where do you see that arc continuing to go for us?
You know, I'm not sure Russia is as big a player in the Middle East as people have been portraying them. Certainly, they've had this very effective intervention in Syria. And I think, you know, I mentioned this a little earlier, but not just successful politically in that they've managed to save the Assad regime, but successful in that they've been able to use it as a training ground for their military to proof a bunch of concepts related to expeditionary forces that they didn't really have before. And so it's been really useful for them in that regard. They've also been expanding their political ties to the region to a certain extent, right? So on oil matters, we have seen closer ties between the Saudis and the Russians. But let's not forget that they still disagree quite violently on everything from Syria to how much Russia should be involved in the region, to Libya, to all of these post-Arab Spring conflicts. So there's still quite a lot of disagreement there. And then Russia has its historic ties to Iran, still sells them a lot of weapons. Russia's trying to expand some of arms sales into other countries. So the Saudis and the Turks are both buying Russian air defense systems. But other than that, Russia is no more involved in the Middle East today than it was a decade ago. So it really has just been the Syria intervention. And I think it remains to be seen whether they have any inclination to intervene in other conflicts. Certainly, they really haven't put any forces on the ground in Libya, which is another place they could have done it. They've stayed uninvolved in Yemen, which is another place they could potentially have got involved. So the scope of what the Russians are doing in the Middle East, it looks like they're doing really well, but it's a pretty narrow scope that they're actually focused on.
Let me shift a little bit to the Russia-China relationship, which has had its rocky moments over the years. What's happening there now other than Russia being willing to sell oil and gas to the Chinese? Is there any increase or decrease in the tension along the border areas?
No more tension than there has been, I would say, in recent years. There's been a little movement in Russian-Chinese relations, mostly on trade issues of mutual benefit. So the Chinese have been helping the Russians bust sanctions a little. It's not even busting sanctions because they're not actually violating it. What they're doing is trading oil in renminbi rather than in dollars, which means that the Russians don't get sanctioned for doing that. So the Chinese have been willing to work with the Russians on some small issues like that. But really the relationship there is the same as it has been for the last decade, which is the Russians would love a closer relationship with Beijing. They would love to build this anti-Western partnership that would see both countries push back against Western institutions. And the Chinese have never gone for it. The Russians have made a number of overtures, and politically the Chinese just have always rejected them. They're just not willing to do that. So what we've seen is Russia has been sort of testing the boundaries with the West in Ukraine and elsewhere. The Chinese have just been sitting back and watching and seeing what the Western reaction is. Some of that is almost certainly informing the ways that China is now working in places like the South China Sea, but they're not really willing to work with the Russians on those issues. So it's this sort of very classic case where one party really wants closer ties in Russia, but the Chinese, they're just not that interested. They don't really see any benefits to closer cooperation with Russia.
You mentioned the West, and kind of an echo of one of our earlier part of the discussion we have is, let's talk a little bit about Western Europe and their confidence or lack of confidence in dealing with Russia. Because when you strip away North America, if you just want to look at it from an EU point of view, or even just non-North American NATO nations, and again, using those objective criteria of demographics, economics, even military spending to that regard, is there should be a lot of confidence in the West towards Russia, but especially with the Germans, there is a lot of hesitancy and lack of self-confidence. How do you see the environment in Western Europe and their confidence and their ability to work with or maneuver as Russia does around the international stage, independent of the U.S.?
Yeah, there's a couple of issues, right? So there's capabilities, and then there's willingness to use those capabilities. And both areas are somewhat problematic. So the Western European states have very much underinvested in defense capacity. Even those states that have historically been better, like the United Kingdom, have seen big drop-offs in recent years. So without the U.S., it's basically impossible for most of those states to engage in any sort of active military action. To give you one example, in the Libya intervention in 2011, the British and the French said that they would take the lead on this. You might remember this was the Obama administration's leading from behind, and they said they would be conducting the strikes. Within 10 days, it became apparent that their forces simply just couldn't sustain the tempo of airstrikes that they needed, and the U.S. had to get involved, and basically the U.S. ends up running the air campaign from there on out. So capabilities remain an issue, and that's before you even get to countries like Germany that just don't have the military capacity. But the bigger, and I'm saying bigger problem, and I'm not actually sure it is a problem, because I think to some extent they're actually correct about judging the threat from Russia. Western European countries in particular do not perceive a major threat from Russia. They see Russia as primarily a provider of energy. They correctly see that this is not a situation of energy vulnerability, but energy interdependence. So Russian energy comes in, Russia could cut off the energy, but if Russia were to cut off the energy, Western Europe would stop paying and the Russian government would collapse. So this is an interdependent relationship, not one where Russia really holds all the cards. So the Western European states just don't see that big a threat from Russia, and they don't really see the need to sort of rearm or take on more of the burden in doing so. And so what we're actually seeing within NATO is it is those new member states, the ones that have acceded to NATO since the end of the Cold War, Poland, the Baltic states, those are the states that are pushing the U.S. to get far more involved in this sort of remilitarization of Europe. In Western Europe, in contrast, the focus has been on diplomatic initiatives. So if you look at the Minsk protocol, if you look at the countries that set up this Normandy-style quartet, they're all European states. So the Germans, the French, working with the Russians, the Ukrainians to try and resolve the conflict, it's all focused on diplomacy and to a certain extent sanctions rather than on building up the military in Western Europe. So that's kind of where the Western European powers stand right now. They don't really want this to become a military arms race. They would much rather see this remain in the political realm, maybe in the economic realm.
Well, there's a couple of questions that go along with that. One is that somebody in the chat room asked, how much does Putin's political viability depend on convincing the Russians that the U.S. and the West are its enemies? And how, is it absolutely necessary that they view the West that way? Because from my experience, NATO couldn't organize a good picnic, let alone invade Russia. But is it necessary for the U.S. to be and the West to be considered enemies for Putin to stay in office?
I think so. I do think so. I mean, this is a classic dictator phenomenon, right? The dictators get stronger the more they're able to portray someone outside as an enemy. The argument is, I am here to protect you. I'm making us strong again, and you have enemies outside. And so I think, you know, there were a number of years where Russian, particularly young Russians, looked to the West as a model that they wanted to emulate. And I think over time, a combination of sort of propaganda, emigration of sort of the best and the brightest, and quite frankly, things like U.S. sanctions, the expansion of NATO, have actually helped bolster this line that the Putin regime has been advancing, that the West is the enemy. And that Putin is here to protect you. If you look at opinion polling in Russia, Vladimir Putin's opinion approval rating right now is actually surprisingly low. He's not doing so great. But if you look over the sweep of time, his approval goes up when there are confrontations with the West. So in 2014, with the seizure of Crimea, his approval rating goes way up. Even with all the economic factors, even with the price of oil collapsing through the floor and the Russian economy going into recession, his approval rating goes up because he sort of stands up to the West and takes these steps. The problem, of course, is there's only so many times you could do that. If the economy continues to be just terrible, the way it is in Russia, there's only so many times that Putin can basically wag the dog in order to keep his approval rating higher. And so persuading everybody that the West is the enemy is a big part of his ability to appeal to the Russian population, but it's not clear that he's getting the same returns. His returns on that seem to be diminishing, is what I'm trying to say.
We've talked a lot about some of the issues and points of friction and disagreement with Russia over the course of the last hour, but you don't have to look too hard to start to see that, at least in theory, if not in practice, that there are areas where Russia and the U.S. were aligned enough that we could or should be working hand in hand on. What are some of those areas you see or you would like to see the U.S. and Russia take a deep breath and realize that they have interests that are aligned that would be useful to us to work in a cooperative manner?
So I think a few of those opportunities have already passed us by, unfortunately. I think Syria a couple of years ago would have been an opportunity. The potential really was there for us to work with the Russians on a peace settlement that would have kept Syria somewhat divided, but perhaps more peaceful than it is today. And we saw the Obama administration try to do that. They weren't hugely successful, but they really weren't willing to commit much to it. So I think that's sort of a lost opportunity. We could be working with Russia on that, and we're really not. The same with some of these other conflicts in the Middle East. Libya, for example, again, we could be working with Russia there, and we're really not. But I think those opportunities today are far fewer than they were even a couple of years ago. So today, if we look at the Trump administration, considering the domestic constraints on the Trump administration, which is to say that it basically can't appear to be friendly towards Russia, we consider the fact that Congress is still openly hostile towards Russia, and then the fact that there just really aren't many of those common areas of interest anymore, it's not clear to me that we actually could make any of those sort of grand bargains with Russia anymore. I think that ship has sailed.
Well, what now that we're down to it, what should our strategy be with respect to Russia?
Yeah, I guess that was a rather depressing note, wasn't it? To be honest, I think the goal for U.S.-Russian relations should be to stop things getting worse. It's not clear that they can be improved. And I think if you ask a lot of Russian specialists about this, they would probably agree. The relationship today is at the worst point that it has been since the end of the Cold War. And every time the relationship has got worse over the last 2.5 decades, we have looked at it and we've said, oh, well, it can't possibly get worse. And it has. And so I think today, for any administration, the first goal really is to stop things getting worse. So whether there are any of these areas where we could either work with Russia or, more potentially, could we come to some kind of agreement that would help to improve the situation? And I think Ukraine is one where this is just ripe for us to try and actually negotiate. For example, accepting de facto Russia's control of Crimea in exchange for the lifting of some sanctions is something that I think Russia, the Putin regime, might actually accept. Moving towards a situation where there's less interference in Ukraine in exchange for a promise that Ukraine won't join NATO, that's something that I think could at least be on the table for discussion. What I worry about is sort of twofold. I think that is a viable political strategy, but I don't think it's viable in this administration. And I alluded to that a minute or two ago, because I think this administration just cannot do anything other than maintain the status quo with Russia. This is going to have to be a strategy for the next administration in 2 years or 6 years, whichever it is. This is going to be a strategy that the next administration has to pursue to try and actually improve these areas. And then the other question really is whether Congress can be made to stop adding on sanctions, making things worse, committing to increased troop deployments in Western Europe. Basically, are we going to end up on a path where we ramp up our troop deployments in Western Europe, the Russians ramp up their troop deployments on the border, and we end up in this sort of spiral of increasing hostility in Eastern Europe? It's not clear to me, again, that we can avoid that, because just politically it's very difficult to step back and say, well, we are not going to take the next step. We are not going to escalate. So I think there is a strategy out there, but it's a very narrow needle to thread, and I don't believe this administration can thread it. I'm not sure if a future administration can do so.
And you hit right on an area that concerns me, because history shows often that large powers that in one way or another can hold the other in some type of existential threat, they'll try to avoid conflict when they can, but oftentimes they, at the end of the day, get entangled with each other, not due to a direct action against each other, but secondhand via one of their medium-sized friends or allies wind up doing something rash or stupid that starts a momentum rolling that eventually leads to conflict between the large powers. When you look at those medium and small powers and friction points between the U.S. and the West, whichever way you want to look at it, and Russia, what are the areas that give you the most concern that people could quickly lose control of events?
In terms of allies, where I think this is a problem, I think the Baltic states are the most obvious candidate here. I personally do not believe that the Russians are going to try and do anything in the Baltic states. I think that there is a huge concrete difference between intervening in a country like Ukraine and intervening in a NATO ally. But I think we can't rule out the possibility of some kind of unplanned border skirmish that gets out of control. So I do worry a little, particularly as I see us rotate in more and more troops into the Baltic states and into Poland. I do worry about that dynamic. I think Ukraine is the second area. Even though Ukraine is not a treaty ally, we are very fuzzy in how we treat our relationship to Ukraine. The entire discussion about the conflict in Ukraine here in Washington has revolved almost around the idea that even though they're not a NATO member, they're somehow obligated to the rights of NATO membership, that because they're on this membership path, we are obligated to protect them as if they were a member. And obviously that's false, but I think we have sort of seen an escalation in U.S. involvement in this conflict. Under the Trump administration, we have actually seen the U.S. government send lethal arms to Ukraine, provide more military support. So that's an area where I do worry, again, that this could sort of spiral out of control in an unplanned way. And then the third thing that I'm going to name is actually not, it's not an ally or partner at all. It is direct U.S.-Russian conflict. The other day, about a week ago, there was a statement from a senior military officer that's been working on Syria issues, and he said, oh, yeah, we've engaged in shooting incidents with the Russians about 5 or 6 times. And so we knew about one of those incidents, which involved a bunch of Russian mercenaries associated with the Wagner group. So not the Russian military directly, but Russian military proxies, and they were fighting U.S. forces. But if this statement is correct, then we've actually engaged in sort of low-level conflict with Russians inside Syria several times. And so that is a huge concern. And while I would not suggest that that could suddenly rise to the level of, you know, nuclear war with Russia, it again opens the door to this idea that we're actively engaged in conflict with Russia and things could escalate out of control. So to be frank, actually, of all three areas, the Baltics, Ukraine, and Syria, I find Syria to be the most concerning, just because it is already direct conflict between the U.S. and Russia.
Well, on that cheerful note, Emma, I want to thank you for being with us today. And let me ask you what things we can be looking forward to from you in the next few months, in addition to your book, which I'm sure will be out any day now, right?
Something like that. I did actually just publish an article on Friday morning that might be of interest. It's at a round table at the Texas National Security Review on the future of conservative foreign policy. And so I'm writing from the libertarian perspective, but there are paleoconservatives and conservative internationalists and all sorts of people. It's a really interesting roundtable.
Well, Anna, as always, I'd also recommend to folks, please look her up on Twitter, which I believe is what, at Emma Ashford itself, or you have an initial in there? There we go. But that's also a great place to keep track of our guests today. Emma Ashford, it's just been a pleasure having you on today to talk about Russia and related issues, and look forward to an opportunity to talk to you again down the road.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being
thank
here.
You very much, everybody. Oh, sorry about that. And thanks, everybody, for joining us for another edition of Midrats. Until next time, I hope everybody has a great Navy Day. Cheers.
Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same. It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go. It's a long way to Tipperary, to the sweetest girl I know. Goodbye, Piccadilly.